This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to Africa News Tonight. Thank you for joining us. I'm Mukbil Yabaro, and here's what's coming up.
Every war that they have ever fought and ended has ended through some kind of ceasefire agreement and peace agreement. It's never involved total battlefield victory. And so that's not something that they're used to, and frankly, not something that they hold out as an expectation of this war.
That was Cameron Hudson of the Center for Strategic Studies Africa program, who says he expects Sudanese army officials to eventually come to the bargaining table to end the war. Also, the 200 countries attending the COP29 climate talks have yet to agree how to reduce the use of fossil fuels. And a political scientist says Ghana's secret to successful elections are strong electoral processes and transparency. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. After 2 weeks of talks at the COP29 climate conference in Baku, Azerbaijan, the 200 countries attending have yet to agree on a way forward to reduce the use of planet-heating fossil fuels. And developing regions, including Africa, continue to press for a larger pool of money to help them tackle climate change. Although a draft proposal has been released, the talks have gone into indefinite overtime, and they have been set to end this evening. Darren Taylor reports.
A draft agreement released Friday proposes that wealthier nations give poorer countries $250 billion annually. This would help them move away from fossil fuels and make their countries resilient to extreme weather. At a news conference in Baku, Mohamed Addo, director of environmental group Power Shift Africa, described the latest COP29 text as a slap in the face. He said it falls far short of the trillions of dollars needed to help the nations in the global south survive global warming.
The rich world has done everything to shirk their responsibility to pay up the climate debt they owe the rest. Baku has to be the moment when we turn this around. This COP has to decide the ways we're going to generate and deliver the much-needed climate finance that the rest of the world expects from the rich historic polluters. You can't let a global minority that is also the wealthiest, that has largely grown rich by polluting the planet without facing the cost of doing so, to get away with their responsibility.
In 2015, developed nations pledged to provide $100 billion a year in climate financing to poorer countries by 2020. They didn't hit that goal until 2022, and Addo says the money came in a form that was just repackaged aid that forced some countries to take on extra debt. He warned the same will happen with a new proposal of $250 billion if it materializes. Indian climate change activist Harjit Singh criticized the draft deal for failing to commit countries to slowing production and use of fuels such as oil and coal, which emit huge amounts of climate-warming carbon gases.
The reality is that developed countries are trying to pose themselves as climate leaders, but back home, they are expanding fossil fuels. We all know countries like the US, UK, Norway, Canada and Australia are going to be responsible for fossil fuel expansion between now and 2050. That's more than 50% of the plans that they have put forward. And the hypocrisy is they want a discussion on it, but they don't want to act upon it back home. And without providing any finance, they want developing countries to move away from fossil fuels.
Addo suggested that some at COP29 are hiding behind US President-elect Donald Trump. He and many of his supporters have called climate change a hoax. Trump has promised that the United States, the second biggest carbon polluter in the world, will ramp up fossil fuel production when he re-enters the White House in 2025.
If you look at the scale of the crisis that we're facing, we can't let one man destroy our common planet. It would be irresponsible to let one man effectively sabotage the collective effort of the rest of the humanity in tackling the biggest geopolitical threat we face.
A recent UN report says 2024 is on track to be the hottest year on record. It says current policies mean the world will warm by 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, which will lead to worse droughts and floods, which will be most dangerous for vulnerable regions like Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A Ghanaian political scientist says the secrets to successful elections in the country are strong electoral processes and transparency. The country will vote December 7th for a new president to succeed incumbent Nana Akufo-Addo of the New Patriotic Party. Former President John Mahama is running on the platform of the National Democratic Congress. The political scientist says despite some challenges, the processes leading to the election have been transparent. He says the Electoral Commission has promised a free and fair election. Dr. Kojo Pumpuni Asante is Director of Policy Engagement and Partnership of Ghana Center for Democratic Development, a non-governmental organization. He told reporter Mike Mboni that preparations for the election have been good.
Yes, I think preparations are good. We had some initial challenges with the register. That has now been overcome. It's been certified. Copies have been given to the parties, and we've moved on with printing of ballots and issues, and all of those things have now been taken. You know, so the Electoral Commission has already dispatched ballot papers and other logistics to all the regions. I think by the end of this Friday, most of that will be completed.
Some African affairs experts, European or Western analysts, say Ghana is a role model for African democracy, that since return to multi-party democracy in 1992, Ghana has held peaceful elections and smooth transitions to new administrations. What's your take on this, sir?
Yes, I think if you compare to many other African countries, we've had very competitive, very highly contested elections. I recall in 2008, the winning vote difference was about 40,000 votes after two rounds and a half of elections, and we were still able to have a peaceful transition. And we've had turnovers at least three times already. So I think that is, at least in terms of our electoral democracy, we've done, and that's not without its challenges. There are always very significant challenges, like the mobilization of different organized civil society groups and different stakeholders to try to manage the situation has been successful in the past. So that's the case. But of course, the health of our democracy overall is also in question, and that is very typical of the democracy project across Africa, as the Afrobarometer data has been showing. So, yes, we've done well with our electoral democracy, and we do have quite a strong electoral system that brings a lot of stakeholders and a lot of transparency through the process. So that's helped us to manage it. But I think we are also feeling the same challenges that many democracies are facing across the continent.
Do you think the presidential election scheduled for December 7 will live up to expectations of Africans as a free and fair exercise?
Yes, I have that optimism, and not as some aspirational expression, but because of the work of civil society media. So, for example, I serve as the secretariat at the Center for Democratic Development. We serve as the secretariat for the Coalition of Domestic Election Observers. We will be deploying 4,000 observers on election day. In those interventions, what media does, what religious groups that do on that day, the kind of accountability that is put on the Electoral Commission and all other stakeholders, that's what tends to deliver free and fair elections. And we'll be trying to do the same December 7th.
That was Kojo Pumpuni Asante, a Ghanaian political scientist, speaking with reporter Mike Mboni by phone from Accra, Ghana. As the war for control of Sudan rages on between two military commanders, the situation is not expected to improve soon. Tens of thousands of civilians have been killed and millions have been displaced. This past week, Cameron Hudson, a senior fellow with the Africa program at the Center for Strategic Studies, met with various Sudanese officials in Port Sudan. He tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that although peace talks are stalled, the Sudanese army appear more willing at this point to reach a negotiated conclusion to its war with the paramilitary rapid support forces.
What I take away from my visit is that I think that the army is actually more prepared to sit down and negotiate than I had anticipated. Every war that they have ever fought and ended has ended through some kind of ceasefire agreement and peace agreement. It's never involved total battlefield victory. And so that's not something that they're used to, and frankly, not something that they hold out as an expectation of this war. And so they are prepared at some point to sit down and talk and negotiate. I think the conditions right now are probably not right for that. And I think both on the battlefield, they're not right, but also I think in the international community, there's no obvious player right now that can that I think can effectively mediate this. And I think they're hoping, moreover, that they can first and foremost get the United Arab Emirates to suspend their support to the rapid support forces. They are entirely convinced that if they can suspend that support, that the war would end literally in a matter of days.
You say they think that, but do you think that too?
I don't know that it's a matter of days, but I think it's a matter of weeks. Yes, I think that the RSF will have a very difficult time sustaining itself. Now, it's making a lot of money in gold exports and other business ventures, which by and large it has not been using to finance this war. So if it chose to use that money to finance the war, it might be able to sustain itself a bit longer. But certainly I think losing the political protection that the Emirates gives as well as the material support would go a long way in not just ending the war, but changing the calculus of the RSF, that they don't have unlimited options, that their options are in fact running out. And by changing that calculus, I think it will change, their willingness to talk.
Are there any talks even going on right now?
No, there are no talks going on right now. I know that both sides say publicly that they would be willing to talk, but right now there is no talk of ceasefire happening.
Does it seem to you like we're still at a point where the two sides are trying to gain ground militarily, literally on the ground before anything gets more real and more official about coming to the negotiating table?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they would be, trying to make ground any way they can, irrespective of whether talks were imminent or going on. That's just the nature of fighting. And so I wouldn't say that either side has an upper hand right now. Maybe the army has a bit more momentum. They've had some early wins. The army is rebuilding itself. It's growing in strength. It's recruiting new recruits, and it is bringing in, new weapons. And so it's I would say, evening the playing field with the RSF, which has had the upper hand for the better part of this war. So there might be a slight momentum shift, but it hasn't translated really into substantial, strategic shifts on the battlefield yet.
That was Cameron Hudson, senior fellow with the Africa program at the Center for Strategic Studies, speaking with my colleague, Carol Van Dam from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. I'm your host, Mukbil Yabaro, in Washington. We'd love to hear from you, and you can share your thoughts about the news in our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1-202-258-3076. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on Africa News Tonight. Governments in Algeria, Morocco, and Tunisia have long preferred to keep their foreign policy options open. They diversify their relations with the many other powers on the scene, including the United States, Russia, and European countries. However, a new study by Carnegie's Middle East program showed that Russian involvement in Libya and Algeria is different from the rest of North Africa. Amr Hamzawi, director of Carnegie Middle East program and co-author of the study, discussed this with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shanawi.
Algeria has always been a stronghold, and Libya has, historically speaking, been a stronghold since 1969, early 70s, and Algeria since its independence, early 1960s, of the former Soviet Union, as well as have kept good relations with Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So the involvement of Russia in Libya, which has come by in the context of the Libyan civil war, has been primarily of military nature, indirectly using different paramilitary groups, the Wagner Group primarily, but being involved in different ways militarily. Russia has not done much economically or in terms of trade with Libya. That's completely to the opposite and to the contrary of the picture we get analytically from looking at Russian-Algerian relations. Russia is in Algeria a trade partner, is in Algeria an arms supplier, but also in Algeria a technology supplier. Algeria signed a new deal with Russia as well. And in the two cases, this is sort of benefiting from the historical legacies and reactivating them. But once again, back in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the Soviet Union was out competing globally for influence and had a clear strategy that went beyond simply disrupting American influences. Right now, all I can see in Russia's roles is to create maneuvering spaces, to create spaces for disrupting the U.S. influence in a regional fashion. So using influence over Algeria to undermine the good relations between the U.S. and Morocco and so on and so forth. That's the overall strategic vision I see emerging in Russia, because it continues to see other regions as way more important. Even in the Middle East and North Africa, the Gulf is way more important for Russian purposes, oil and other questions on trade, way more important than North Africa.
With President-elect Donald Trump's strategy of America first, how do you expect the U.S. competition with Russia, China, and the MENA region to be?
This is a big question mark. I believe the U.S. under Trump will be interested in containing, in one way or another, wars which erupted in the region in the last 2 years, primarily in Gaza, in Lebanon, the ongoing military tensions around Yemen, the role of Iran and its proxies. So it will be interested in containing wars and containing Iran and its proxies. I believe the U.S. under Trump will not per se mind collaborating with China or Russia if collaboration is possible, maybe in some places like Syria, maybe in with regard to Iran, and the U.S. could collaborate in the containment efforts as well. But the drive of the Trump administration will certainly be to contain conflicts and tensions emerging out of the Middle East and North Africa. That does not mean that they are going to recognize the real root causes on the ground, which is in relation to the Gaza war, the question of Palestinian self-determination, which is in relation to Lebanon, the question of Lebanese national sovereignty, in Yemen, a question of recreating a state after years of civil wars, in relation to Iran, a question of managing the ambitions of a regional power feels insecure with regard to the role and policies of a different regional power, which is Israel. So whether they will recognize Middle East aspirations or not remain to be seen. I also believe that the U.S., to an extent, under Trump, will not invest a great deal of its diplomatic capital, economic and military capital in the region if its initial initiatives or pushes for containment and pacification will not yield positive results. So it remains to be seen. This is very much the analysis is relevant maybe for the first year. Beyond that, it will be a question of what the results are going to be.
That was Amer Hamzawi, Director of Carnegie Middle East Program, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week
right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Now to sports. I have our VOA sports reporter, Mike Hovey, on A&T today. Thanks for joining us on this show, Mikey.
Yes, sir. What's good?
Absolutely good, man. In the world of football, AFCON qualifiers are done. Who have been the biggest surprises in the groups, bro?
Man, oh man, this has been a really exciting, and I'm looking forward to AFCON 2025, might I add. A couple of teams already secured. Well, it's done and dusted, so we know who's qualified and who hasn't qualified. But to jump into it, I'll talk about the surprises or the upsets is what I'll call them. The first one, of course, has to be highlighted, Ghana's Black Stars. Probably the biggest team to not secure qualification. They finished at the bottom of Group F with only 3 points, no victories whatsoever. So they're among the biggest upsets. A couple of others, so we saw a couple of other teams who did really, really well in the previous Africa Cup of Nations, but did not even make it to AFCON 2025. Among them, Cape Verde, right? They made it to the quarterfinals, if I remember correctly, against South Africa's Bafana. So, and now they didn't even secure qualification. Gambia is another team that dropped out of AFCON. We also have Guinea-Bissau, which is another team that dropped out of AFCON. And, of course, Guinea is another team that did not secure qualification. One of the biggest, great stories that came out of these qualifications, we'll talk about Sudan. They're a team who hadn't played in the Africa Cup of Nations in a very, very long time. They've only won AFCON once, which is when they hosted it in probably like 1970 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And since then, they've only made it past the group once, and they've only qualified out of the 24 editions of the Africa Cup of Nations 3 times. So to see them be the teams that are going to be headed to Morocco is another exciting story. Of course, teams that have advanced, some of the names don't even need to be mentioned. Morocco, the hosts, Nigeria, Super Eagles, Zambia, DRC is among the list. South Africa's Bafana is among the list. Cameroon's on the list. Senegal is on the list. There's a couple of big hitters who stood their time and are going to be there in Morocco.
Absolutely. And a quick shout out also to Comoros.
Yes, sir. Finished top their group. Top their group.
That wasn't too easy of a group either. Tunisia, Gambia, and Madagascar.
Yes, sir. Top their group came out looking good, 12 points. Off that, 3 wins, 3 draws, no losses whatsoever. So they're standing tall. They're looking really good.
Love to see it, man. Staying on football, Mike, the Premier League is back on this weekend. What games are the biggest ones to watch?
Goes without a saying. Mm-hmm. Manchester United. This is probably going to be one of the most watched games of the season. And not because of the stature of the teams playing, but because, of course, everybody's been watching the developments with Manchester United. And Manchester United recently got a new manager, and he opens his season on Sunday up against Ipswich. So that's one of the games that people are definitely going to be looking at. And I could easily argue that's probably going to be one of the most watched games this weekend. We're also going to have Man City Tottenham. That's another interesting one that's going to be a big burner. We're going to look at one more team to point out, Arsenal, Nottingham Forest. You're both fighting for that third, fourth spot, so it's an exciting thing to watch.
Absolutely. Lastly, if we're going to go into Jake Paul versus Mike Tyson was somewhat of a disappointment.
Snoozer.
Absolutely. but can Jake Paul continue this machine that he's created, this eyes that he has on himself, and what would a potential fight between him and maybe Canelo Alvarez or a Conor McGregor look like, as he's called out both of them online?
Look, he's managed to garner a lot of attention. Like it or not, one thing people have applauded is the eyeballs that he's giving towards both MMA and boxing. Now, of course, MMA is still riding high, but boxing is a sport that slowly became like the distant cousin to MMA. So he's doing a really great thing. I'm curious to see who he's going to fight next.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that sports wrap-up, Mike. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Mukbil Yabaro in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Dave Vandy, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.